The beautiful beast, the blonde angel of hell, the hyena of Auschwitz, the bitch of Belsen. These are just a few of the nicknames given by concentration camp prisoners to Irma Gresser, one of the most reviled figures in Holocaust history. By her early 20s, Gresser was one of the most feared female Nazis, inflicting horror on her subjects in camps across Germany and Poland, including at the notorious Auschwitz-Birkenau. Join me as I look at the making of a monster. Primary sources for this episode include History Today, All That's Interesting, The Mirror, The Bill of Rights Institute, Holocaust Encyclopedia, Warfare History Network, the Holocaust Research Project.org, the Jewish Virtual Library, and bergenbelsen.co.uk. Hi guys, welcome back to episode 155 of Unknown Passage, a podcast that tells the stories of those who have gone missing or have been murdered abroad. I hope that you're all doing well. I'd like to welcome new patron Sarah B. Could be Sarah or could be Sarah. I don't really have the answer to that. She said, just whatever, as long as you say it in an Aussie accent, which you got it. So Sarah. So, and also thank you to patrons who upped to annual membership, existing patrons, Jamie G, Caitlin, Petra, and Jody B. Thanks so much. So I'm going to get straight into this week's case. Last week, we were in the wilds of British Columbia, Canada, and this week we're jetting across to Europe, to a couple of countries actually, both of which we have been to previously on the podcast. And this is a location request for patron Cheryl L. Now, Cheryl is from New Jersey. Sorry, I can't help it. She grew up on Long Island. And one of her guilty pleasures, which I know a lot of you over there love it, is maths, the Australian Married at First Sight. And she loves it. She says it's better than the American one, which I've heard, like, you guys seem to like it, and especially in the UK as well. I only watch season one. I think I'm the only Australian who doesn't watch maths religiously, but I just can't get into it. And she has three beautiful kitty cats. And Cheryl's family is, I won't say her surname, but it's a Polish surname. And her family's Polish, so one of her requests was Poland. So that's what I've gone with for this week's episode. It was going to be one part, but then I realised that the story of Irma Gresser can't just be condensed into one part. Unfortunately, most of the horrors of what she committed will be on part two, but it's important to kind of spread it out and talk about her upbringing, I guess, if you want to apply a nature v nurture argument to it. But I just want to say from the start, I will not be applying any kind of poor Irma mental health lens to this. Whatever was going on in her head, I do not care. I believe that she was evil through and through. So that's how I've tackled it. Feel free to start a podcast if you want to and talk about, you know, what created her and all that stuff. I just won't be doing that. She doesn't deserve it. And as we get into it, she barely deserves a podcast or to have her name ever mentioned again. So that's been a stretch for me as well. So about a year ago, I was researching some Nazi hunter stuff to cover for this podcast. And I read a statistic randomly that I did not know, even though Holocaust history is like a niche interest of mine, which I've talked about on a bunch of different episodes. And I read a statistic on NBC News that I screen capped and I held onto it for later use because I thought that's crazy and it shouldn't be that way. And this is what it read, quote, survey finds shocking lack of Holocaust knowledge amongst millennials and Gen Z. 63% of those surveyed did not know 6 million Jews were murdered in the Holocaust. Over half of those thought the toll was under 2 million, unquote. So as someone who's always been fascinated by this era and time and visited quite a number of cities that were kind of central to the Holocaust, as well as I've talked about my experience visiting Auschwitz, I believe I talked about it on the Max Spears episode, and it's a regular theme that runs throughout this. I read you a bit of Viktor Frankl's book, and, you know, it comes up. Obviously, it's a central part of a lot of nations' histories, particularly European, and one day we'll go to Israel, and it's very central to that too. And this statistic really saddened me, because I'm a millennial, and I feel like most millennials I know understand the gravity. I know a lot don't understand how many people were killed in the Russian gulags under Stalin, which is less of something that everyday people knew, but I really thought it'd be more than 63% would know the gravity of what happened during the Holocaust. And I always planned on profiling Nazis on this podcast, many who have fled, and I've got quite a lot, you know, on my list to do, many of them lesser known. And I started to think, like, if people or millennials or Gen Z or even older generations don't know that, what's the likelihood that they don't know that it wasn't just men that committed atrocities? I feel like that's what people generally picture. And that's not the case at all. At one point in time, like 1 in 10 Nazis or working in concentration camps were women. And women did commit many atrocities. Some of their names are incredibly well known. Irma Gresso is one of them. Ilse Koch's another one. Maria Handel is another one. The list goes on. Many prisoners actually cite women as far worse in their treatment of prisoners in concentration camps than men, which is, I find, something that people will struggle with that concept. But this is coming from survivors who spoke at the trials of many of these women and told what had happened to them. Many of them said that exact thing. And I think this is why people struggle with women who kill or women who kill their children. And in this instance, women who inflict torture that they actually didn't have to inflict. They were there to hold law and order in the concentration camps, but some of them were incredibly sadistic, and Irma Gresso was one of them. And it's because biologically women are nurturers, they're maternal. You just don't expect women to treat people like this, but to treat other women like this, which is what these female guards were tasked with, looking after thousands of women, looking after quote unquote. Many of the survivors would say that they were more vicious, more calculating, more sadistic. And that's a pretty tall order considering what we know a lot of the men, the male Nazis who worked in the different camps during the Holocaust were like. And they seem to revel in it a lot more, according to survivors. Then last month was the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz in late January, and I felt it was time to tell the tale of one of the lesser known names of the Holocaust, because she's a woman, but one of the worst individuals of the entire Second World War, Irma Gresso. Irma, to me, is a blueprint on how not to live your life. Nothing excuses what she did. She had choices at every opportunity. A lot of women, while being registered Nazi Party members, which most Germans were, you know, at the time, it did not mean that they worked in camps or anything like that just to be a registered member. No one forced these women to take these jobs. There were other options for them. She made choices at every turn along the way to do what she wanted, and she, I believe, felt that this was her calling. She's a reprehensible figure that was so evil by her late teens, early 20s. It's really hard to fathom at a time when usually people get harder as they get older. I believe she was probably inherently evil from a very young age, and I believe she needed to be removed from society permanently, and thankfully she was, which we'll talk about on part two. Irma Gresso and Ilse Koch are two of the most reviled female concentration camp guards, with a plethora of nicknames that prisoners would give them. I knew the broad strokes about both of them. I knew the nicknames. And I also often, like a lot of you who have heard of Irma Gresser or Ilsa Koch, but Irma Gresser in particular, I also knew the little kind of factual tidbit, which is actually not factual, and that is that Ed Gein, when he was caught and his house was searched by police and they found all this hideous, horrible stuff throughout his house, they would find books on female Nazis, which is true, and they would find lampshades and things like that made out of human skin, which is true as well. Now, the rumour was always that Irma Gresser had lampshades made out of Jewish skin, but that has actually been proven to be factually inaccurate. She actually didn't, but I believe that's only because she hadn't come up with the idea. If she had, she probably would have had her whole house upholstered in Jewish skin, and it's not too much of a stretch because when I went to the Oskar Schindler Museum in Krakow in Poland, which is the site of the original fabrication factory that you can still visit, which is an incredible museum, and I talked about it on the Max Spears episode. I have a photo of various things from throughout the museum, and one of them is a cigarette case that's made out of Jewish skin. So it's not too much of a stretch to think that you could have a lampshade made out of it as well. But I do just want to say from the outset that that has been proven to be myth that's kind of based in truth. So I guess we should go back to the very beginning, as we always do, to build a case for how this young woman became just such a reviled figure. Irma Ilsa Ida Gresser, was born to Alfred and Berta Gresser on October 7th, 1923. One other source has an Elizabeth wedged in there as an additional middle name, but, I mean, who really cares? Maybe they were going for the IIIG. This year, Irma, if she had made it, would have turned 100. She would be turning 100, but that was if she wasn't an absolute demon wench who completed her entire life arc by the age of 22. Irma was born in a pretty little German village called Vrecken, but it's spelt with a W, but it's pronounced Vrecken, in the region of Mecklenburg, Germany. So when you look this up, it's basically in the northeast of Germany, just north of Berlin. I think it's about an hour and a half to 2 hours drive, kind of over towards the Polish border. It's a charming little town, very green. There's a big lake that looks beautiful in pictures that people have put up, particularly in summer. And it's home to around 5,000 people today. A lot of people kind of move out, I guess, and commute close to Berlin. Her parents were dairy workers and worked very hard, and they had five children, which was common back then as they were put to work, essentially. Irma was the third of the five children. It was three girls and two boys. According to trial transcripts, it was Alfred, which they don't have a birth year for, but I believe probably around 1919 or 1922. Lieschen at 1921, Irma in 1923, Helena in 1926, and Otto in 1929. So all in a very quick succession. And her mother was obviously quite young because women got married and had kids, and especially rurally, quite young back then. So these were all kind of children born of out of the end of the First World War, which I'll talk about the ramifications of that on Germany and why a lot of Germans were kind of having to work extremely hard and doing it quite tough. Alfred Gresser is a very interesting figure reading about him. Irma's father, he was known to be a very strict Christian. He was very conservative and extremely strict, and he was known to regularly kind of beat his children. So this is the early 1920s, and people when you picture the 20s, you picture the flapper era and La Belle Époque in Paris. And I'm on season 4 of Peaky Blinders, so we're kind of in the 20s, but it pretty much starts out at the same time. It's post-war. And I guess people across Europe were doing it tough. Everyone was, and a lot of people were dealing with the fallout from World War One. People were still reeling from that, especially Germans who had had harsh sanctions imposed on them in the fallout of World War One, that many would point to later on as an economic factor for the beginning of World War Two and the massive support that the Nazi Party had as a result. People dealt with a lot back then, and life was really hard, and they generally had many children in quick succession and generally hoped for boys in order for the family lineage to carry on and for them to work hard. And I guess if you ended up just having girls, you'd have no other choice but to put them to work. As Irma grew up, she didn't show the traits, it seems, that she would later on that would earn her some of the most evil nicknames of the entire Holocaust. Her sister Helena, who spoke at Irma's trial later on and seems to be the only sibling who openly came to Irma's defense in some sort of way, tried to justify Irma's behavior, would later say, quote, "In primary school, when girls were quarreling and fighting, Irma never had the courage to fight, but ran away," unquote. At this time, not very far away in Berlin, Adolf Hitler had been grifting his way to the top post after serving in the First World War, and he became Chancellor of Germany in 1933. We've kind of touched on this on other episodes, but this is just a very quick crash course. His party, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, shortened to the Nazi Party, became the ruling party in 1933, and ultimately they would rule with an iron fist in a fascist sense, albeit they would drip feed these kind of restrictions on people in stages so as not to alert people as to what was truly happening. Adolf Hitler used German pride and patriotism as the basis for turning the minds of Germans rotten, basically. Germany had been degraded globally since their loss in World War One, which led to the Treaty of Versailles. And as a result of the Treaty of Versailles, harsh economic restrictions were placed on Germany, and the economy was really decimated as a result. Once the Great Depression rolled around, Germany was in a severe crisis. They felt downtrodden. They felt, you know, lesser than when they had always been told they were better than. And the space was ripe for a leader that would renew the pride that Germans once felt while getting them on the right track socially and economically, and to be a world leader again. A charismatic leader who had a vision for Germany was very much needed. And Adolf Hitler used these various social factors to draw overwhelming support. When I was in year 11, we studied the Holocaust, and the final essay we had to write was whether or not I actually had a Jewish teacher, actually, Mrs. Cohen. And it was, you had to place an argument as to whether it was economic factors that led to it. It was Adolf Hitler's charismatic leadership, or if it was social factors. And I can't remember what I went with back then. What I wrote, I've probably got it somewhere. So the Führer, who was the leader of the party, that's the title, he turned Nazism not just into a political party, but a movement and essentially a cult. He drip-fed slowly at first the idea that inferior, quote-unquote, races were holding Germany back, the Jews being one of them, but also this extends when you get into it more. I don't even want to talk about it because it's horrible, and I've listened to watched a lot of shows and read a lot about it. People who physically were lesser than, people with disabilities, things like that. And he really wanted to instill the idea that Germans were in fact the master race. Germans really flocked to sign up as a registered party member. People seem to think that only the SS, who worked, you know, in in ranked positions within the party and, you know, worked in concentration camps and worked in the various kind of roles across Europe at the time, were the only registered party members. But it's not, you know, it wasn't like that. Most regular people were registered party members, but they would still, a lot of them would still just go to work and lead quote-unquote normal lives without being a cog in the machine, so to speak. So I just want to clear up that that's just, you know, not the case. There was millions and millions of members. By the time that Adolf Hitler came to power, 850,000 Germans had signed up as Nazi Party members, card-carrying Nazi Party members. Now, I read a statistic and it was really hard to get the numbers on this. I had to turn to Cora. Some historian gave the answer, but then I found another one that said when he first, after the First World War, where he first started going to meetings for the National Socialist Workers' Party, they only had like 2,000 members, I read. So these numbers kind of show the sheer power that Hitler held in order to convince people to sign up. So by 1933, it was 850,000. But I actually read something interesting that I didn't know. I read about how Hitler really struggled to get everyday blue-collar workers to sign up for the party initially. So the everyday worker made up 46% of German society, but they only made up 30% of membership of the Nazi Party, and Hitler saw this as an issue. Whereby white-collar employees, you know, teachers, you know, office workers, things like that, they made up the majority of the Nazi Party members. So it was harder to get the blue-collar workers, you know, on board with this. And they made up a much smaller percentage of the German population, but a huge percentage of the Nazi Party membership. So he really lent on this and started getting a lot more everyday workers, as they put it, to sign up. And before long, the party had 2 million members. In 1936, Irma's father, Alfred Gresser, had an affair with, according to a couple of sources, it was a local pub owner's daughter in the village, which isn't ideal because it's always going to get back to the wife. And it did. When Berta Gresser, Irma's mum, found out in 1936 when Irma was 13 years old, Berta went and drank hydrochloric acid and killed herself out of the sheer grief of it. She was only 32, according to Irma's later trial transcripts. Now, Irma being 13, this is an extremely pivotal age to lose a mother as a girl, and I'm never going to make excuses for Irma. There's just a lot of plot points in her story where you wonder, if that hadn't happened, you know, would this have happened? If that hadn't happened, would this have happened? But also to be left with a very strict father who was the one who would regularly, you know, beat them if they were naughty and things like that, and was, she felt very contained by his conservatism. That would be a profoundly difficult time to be left without a mother. So that's kind of where my sympathy ends. So Alfred Gresser, he's very interesting. He's a bit of a kind of anomaly because he's a registered Nazi Party member, probably from sheer pressure, societal pressure, but he was vehemently in his personal life anti-Nazi and wouldn't associate, it seemed, with people who were really gung-ho about the movement. He kind of kept to himself, albeit back then you wouldn't openly say you were anti-Nazi, or you would be probably dragged in and never seen again at this point in time. But he was not on board with the early kind of teenage hubbub, particularly between Irma and her sister Helena, who were both very interested in the Nazi Party, who was now looking at indoctrinating children and girls into the movement. But unfortunately, all of them were at school, you know, during the day. And the thing was, Alfred could not control what they learnt at school, which was essentially called the Enabling Act. This was brought in 1933, so when Irma was 10. And this mandated a Nazi education in all elementary schools. So no matter what he did, he couldn't stop that indoctrination while they were at school. So things rapidly started to unravel for Irma Gresser thereafter. And by the age of about 15 or just short of 15, she dropped out of school. At this point, Irma had kind of blossomed into a lot of people would say she's beautiful. I mean, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. I mean, once you know what she's done, it's hard to look at pictures of her and see that. But I can see why they would think that in photos where she's smiling. Now, unfortunately for her, or fortunately for us, the main picture of Irma that you see when you look up Irma, and if you're listening on Spotify, it's the episode photo. She's a sourpuss. As my mother would say, she's got a face like a fart. Now, to put it in context, she was about to be executed shortly thereafter. She was on trial for her life. So, I mean, she's not going to be smiling. But when you look at pictures of her a couple of years before where she's smiling, you can understand that she was the perfect Nazi, you know, female. Blonde hair, blue eyes. She looks quite short. She looks very young, but she was. If you have to remember that. You know, I'm trying not to give too much away, but at the peak of her career, she was like 20 years old. She looks quite short. She's kind of got that angular face. Her eyes, I mean, the photo is taken when she's on trial, so she's got pretty big bags under her eyes. She's probably losing a bit of sleep, maybe regretting her involvement in things to try to save herself. But she's got that perfectly coiffed. In America, they called them victory rolls, but I don't know what they called them in Germany at the time, that very wartime hairdo, which she was very vain and she would spend a lot of time on her appearance. And she, when she dressed, it was perfectly pressed. Everything was perfectly clean. She took a lot of pride in her appearance, which was a major factor of being a Nazi. Most Nazis presented, you know, pristine. Now, at this time in 1938, war was about to ignite, which would happen in 1939. And her father, Alfred, had joined the Nazi party probably begrudgingly in 1937, which is quite kind of late in the game, I suppose. But this is what Germans did. And I feel like Alfred was probably had to publicly put on a persona that he was supporting it when in fact he wasn't. But what makes him an anomaly is that while many registered party members who were parents of children actively encouraged their children to join the Hitler Youth branches of the Nazi party, you got to train and indoctrinate those kids early. Alfred Gresser forbade this for his children, particularly for his daughters. There was no way they were going to join what was called the League of German Girls. In German, this is called Bund Deutscher Mädel. And this was kind of the Girl Scouts for young, teenage, you know, females. And then you had the Hitler Youth for males. The girls expressed interest in joining and Alfred put his foot down. Alfred Gresser reminds me a lot, if you know The Sound of Music, which is one of my favourite movies of all time, and I did a really geeky tour in Salzburg where they took you to all the filming locations and it's actually awesome. And you drive around in a bus singing the songs from it. I kept coming back to the fact that he reminds me so much of Captain Von Trapp from The Sound of Music, who Christopher Plummer plays, the father. Captain Von Trapp was a registered Nazi party member, but if you remember, he is completely anti-Nazi. And when they put up the flag, you know, he tears it down. There's that famous scene where he takes it and he tears it in half. And he hates the fact that Liesl, his eldest daughter, is kind of having this romance with Rolf, who is a Hitler Youth member. He's a teenager. And he tries to scare off Rolf every chance he can. And in the end, Rolf is the one. He was right, because Rolf is the one who gives up their location. And, you know, when they're hiding out in the convent. And Alfred Gresser reminds me a lot of Captain Von Trapp. Alfred Gresser remarried in 1939, according to trial transcripts. His second wife was widowed. And as was the case, women generally had to marry again in order to support themselves. And she had four children. So, you know, the two families got together, Brady Bunch style, but not at all. And there was 9 kids now. And so I guess, like, at this point, Irma would, when she eventually moved out of home and she was not even 18, you can kind of see why she would. And then Alfred would go on to, with his second wife, have another daughter, which would be 10 children in total. Irma, meanwhile, after dropping out of school, tried to find her feet in an economy that was floundering. She worked on a local farm for about 6 months and she wasn't into that. And then she worked in a shop for a little while and she wasn't into that. At this point, jobs would have been quite hard to come by. And then she got a job at an SS hospital for a short amount of time. Irma, unbelievably, actually had dreams of being a nurse, which when we talk about what she would go on to do, I will say, I was saying this to someone recently, some of the worst people I've ever met in terms of just behaviour and things are people who said that when they were kids they wanted to be a doctor or a nurse. Yeah, without getting into that too much, like I just, it always stands out to me, the most calculating, mean-spirited people. Whereas the ones who actually just go and do it, just put their heads down and get through school and, you know, apply themselves. And I have so much respect for nurses and doctors. I'm constantly being looked after by them as recently as last week in hospital for my condition. But then there's some that never achieve it. And that's Irma Gresser. And I think it's because she failed every time she tried to, because there was something within her that pushed back against that, because I think she was evil. But luckily for Irma, despite no jobs sticking or really drawing her interest, the war was soon in its early days. And she was essentially an adult by these standards in the late 1930s. So she said, fuck what dad says, as did her sister, and Irma moved to the SS Female Helpers Training Base, which was located near the village of Ravensbrück in Germany. Now, if that's a familiar term, Ravensbrück, to you, it's an all-female concentration camp, which is one of the most notorious. It's often named, you know, on lists of the most notorious ones, but what made Ravensbrück unique was the fact that it was all female. At this stage, Irma was 16 and she decided that she wanted to study nursing. And while at Ravensbrück, she trained under a famous orthopedic surgeon who was famous across Europe called Karl Gebhardt. Now, later, when a lot of doctors were tried at Nuremberg, but people like Joseph Mengele were not, because he was on the run in South America until like the 60s when he died and they never caught him. A lot of doctors would be tried at Nuremberg, but only a couple would actually be executed. Now, Karl Gebhardt would be tried later on at Nuremberg, and witnesses to the atrocities that he did at various camps, predominantly Ravensbrück, on female prisoners, it would all be laid bare. The extent of his medical experiments all came to light, and just a couple of them. One of them was bone grafting medical experimentation on living human subjects at Ravensbrück, using sulfur drugs for gangrenous wounds and transplanting bones in an attempt to regenerate severed nerves were among the medical experiments that he did. And there's kind of a myth that the Nazis pioneered a lot of medical treatments. That's untrue. It seems people, it's kind of a myth, another myth that goes around about them. They actually really achieved very little. It's one of kind of my areas of interest in Holocaust history, reading about the different medical experiments. And I kind of went hard, like about a year into it. And while some of them are just so impossible to read about, because you can't imagine other than Japan during World War II doing similar things on living human subjects, you can't imagine a human mind coming up with these kinds of things, let alone acting them out. And obviously a lot of you will know Mengele's obsession with twins and things like that. But he was an orthopedic surgeon, so this Gebhardt, his interest was in bones, and you can only imagine what these people went through, and these experiments were not done under any kind of anesthesia. When I was researching this about a year ago, I came across a couple of Joseph Mengele's experiments regarding, he was very interested in the endocrine system, and it kind of drew my interest because that's kind of what my issue is, which is hormones. And one of his experiments was to take two twins, one was a control and one was the test subject. He removed the thyroid of one of them and stitched her up and didn't give her replacement drugs, and then he just let him go back out into Auschwitz, into the camp, and pretty much did set a timer to see how long it would take for the twin who had the thyroid removed, which it's amazing they even survived it back then, in a dodgy barn that he was working in, how long it took them to drop dead. And he kind of figured out that it was about 2 weeks. Just evil, evil shit. There's no issue with thinking, I wish these people would die, or wishing ill on these people. In fact, I think it's humane to wish that kind of stuff on these kinds of people. Many believe that Irma, while watching Dr. Gebhardt, relished in witnessing these painful experiments that he would carry out, and that she was, in fact, a sadist. She would go on to become an assistant nurse, but she would never go beyond that because she wasn't good enough intellectually or otherwise to be a proper nurse. And it seems that they kind of eventually realised this, and Carl Gebhardt kind of said, oh, you should go for this job at Ravensbrück. And it almost seemed like he was trying to get rid of her. I don't think she was any good. She'd barely had an education as it was, and she doesn't strike me as the type that would have an interest in the inner workings of nursing or chemistry or any kind of subsection of it. Irma found being out of home obviously liberating, even when she was witnessing some of the worst atrocities in human history, because compared to her strict conservative life at home with her father, anything was better than that, which is a very odd trait for a young woman, as well as the fact that Irma, since she was a child, she hated like liberal policies and what she saw as decadence in society. So obviously her father's attitude had kind of rubbed off on her without her realizing. She pushed against it so much she hadn't realized that she was her father, kind of. But that's a strange trait for a young woman to have, or a young man, because normally people are more liberal when they're younger, and as they age, they become more conservative naturally. So it's very strange, like, from being a child to see hatred in liberal policies. And also it's bullshit, because you'll later find out that, you know, she was liberal with all kinds of shit, including sex, with all kinds of people. So it's all just crap. The fascism of the Nazis also gave Irma the order that she felt everyone should abide by. By 1939, the Nazi Party had 6 million members, and also in 1939, the membership was generally 81% male and 19% female, and that's only because most women didn't sign up as registered party members of a political party. But side note, even as the atrocities of war became apparent and the war was pretty much almost at its end in 1945, the Nazi Party reached its peak membership in 1945. I read it was about 8 million. So 2 million more signed up in the dying days, which is just crazy. It's that last push, you know, which would make no difference. So membership of the Nazi Party was split into different factions. You had, you know, regular people, you had military members, so the military members were members of the Nazi Party who had ambitions to serve in the military. They were regularly encouraged to join what was called the Waffen-SS, and a lot of them enlisted in the Wehrmacht, and a lot of them kind of ended up being drafted into service. Then there were memberships for those who lived outside Germany, which I did not know. Then they had youth memberships, obviously, with the Hitler Youth and the Female Youth League that I talked about earlier with Irma. They also had students that being targeted for membership. In 1926, you know, 7 years before Adolf Hitler would become chancellor, the Nazi Party formed a special division to engage students, and this was known as the National Socialist German Students League. So they had all these irons, like, in the fire, because they knew that the way to kind of target the masses was to indoctrinate the children. The National Socialist Women's League was the women's organisation of party membership, and by 1938 it had approximately 2 million members, which doesn't really gel with the number that they said total members by 1938 was 6 million. Oh, yeah, so it was probably like a third. So women really got on board with this, which again goes against the maternal nature, but a lot of people later on would say, I didn't know what was going on, or I was only following orders. You know, you've lived through the last 3 years, you've had a bit of a taste of how that works. It wasn't long after the war started that female guards and Nazi Party members kind of became central to the war effort on the German side. Not just for membership numbers, but for the running of concentration camps and women's compounds, because they realised that they needed women of a certain ilk to oversee these ever-increasing numbers of prisoners in concentration camps. And of course, I think part of this is psychological. Women, as I've said before, are biologically more maternal and nurturers. And early on, not that it's to do with this episode, but early on, they would, you know, they relied heavily on propaganda, control of information, as they called it. And essentially, they would put out videos, or, you know, a lot of them directed by a woman called Leni Riefenstahl, who was like a filmmaker for the Nazis. And maybe one day I'll cover her on this. We studied her in school. They would put out videos showing the concentration camps as like a little kind of caravan park getaway almost. And you can still see a few of these where it had kids playing and things like that. It was all fake. It was all set up, obviously. When they got there, it would be entirely, you know, the opposite of that, where there would be no escape. But they were fed this lie that you got there and you would eventually be able to go home. It was only for a short amount of time. We were resettling you, kind of thing. And so by having women there, it kind of almost puts people into a false sense of security, that there's these mother figures there and, you know, they'll probably look after you, when the reality is completely different. So to me, it's almost like you're rotting society from the inside out, because the women's influence is going to reach kind of everything. There are many notorious concentration camps you may know by name across Europe, and particularly Poland and Germany. Auschwitz, Birkenau, Dachau, Sachsenhausen, Treblinka, Sobibor, Bergen-Belsen, Mauthausen, and Ravensbrück, just to name a few, although each one has so many stories, you know, and so many. Yad Vashem on the website, you can watch so many. Thankfully, they documented so many survivors' stories and filmed them in the 70s and 80s, so that it's like, you know, this time capsule for what happened, which is so incredible. If you ever go on the website and just watch the different clips of them talking. Sachsenhausen was one that, when I was traveling through Europe the first time, and I was in Prague, I think, I met a lot of people who were coming from Germany into Prague who had just visited Sachsenhausen. You can still visit it. You can still visit Dachau. Before Auschwitz, when it was behind, you know, the Iron Curtain, being in Poland, my mother went to Dachau, you know, in the 70s and 80s, because it was before the wall came down, so you couldn't visit Auschwitz-Birkenau. You can still visit sites like Treblinka and Sobibor, although there's not a lot there. A lot of these sites are just open fields with some sort of memorial. I believe you can still visit Mauthausen, and Ravensbrück, which we'll talk about now, has a small museum. It's nothing on the scale of Auschwitz or anything like that, but you can visit it, but apparently it's quite hard to get to. Off the beaten path of backpackers and the like going through Europe, but each concentration camp would ultimately have female wings. And in fact, according to Holocaust Encyclopedia, which I believe is run by Yad Vashem, which is a great source, quote, between 1933 and 1945, Nazi Germany and its allies established more than 44,000 camps and other incarceration sites, including ghettos, unquote. So 44,000 camps, including just across all countries that were taken by the Nazis, including into France, and including obviously ghettos, famous ones depicted in Schindler's List, the Krakow ghetto depicted in The Pianist, the Warsaw ghetto, 44,000 in total. In May 1939, the SS opened Ravensbrück, the largest Nazi concentration camps established purely for women, although later on they would have a small camp on the exterior that was for men. Over 100,000 women were incarcerated at Ravensbrück by the time that Soviet troops liberated the camp in 1945. We've talked about this before, the Soviet liberation of the camps in Poland, whereas British troops and American troops generally came from the West. So they liberated, you hear a lot of stories from American troops liberating Dachau and liberating Sachsenhausen and Bergen-Belsen and things like that. Ravensbrück camp is located near the village of Ravensbrück in northern Germany. It was actually just up the road, almost literally from where Irma was born and raised, so it was perfect for her. I'm sure she saw it as fate that it opened up there. According to Holocaust Encyclopedia, the inmates came from over 30 countries. They were obviously brought there on trains and in shipments. The biggest number of prisoners there came from Poland, Polish Jews and other, people that they wanted to dispose of, which I'll talk about in a minute. 21% came from the Soviet Union, 18% came from the German Reich, which included Austria, 8% came from Hungary, 6% came from France, 3% came from what was then Czechoslovakia, 2% came from Benelux, which is Belgium, the Netherlands and Luxembourg, and 2% came from Yugoslavia. And when you go to these camps, they talk about how there was a real hatred in particular for Hungarian Jews. They talked about that quite a lot at Auschwitz. There were certain nationalities, Czech Jews. When I was in Prague, I went to the different synagogues there, and there was a sign that said that Hitler referred to Czech Jews in particular as quote unquote vermin, and I'll always remember that. Various types of prisoners were in Ravensbrück, and that was not just Jewish prisoners. This also included political prisoners, people referred to as asocials. So this was a lot of people who were in this group generally came under Roma, which was gypsies, which was a huge, people don't realize that or forget that, but a huge percentage of people who were exterminated during the Second World War were gypsies, Jehovah's Witnesses, criminals, the work shy, and race defilers. Now, one of the ones that they leave off is disabled people, but they were generally taken to death camps and immediately killed. When you go to Auschwitz, they talk about how depending on what you were there for, you had a particular color armband. So I believe pink, the pink Star of David was homosexuals, which they don't actually talk about in regards to Ravensbrück because they kind of pretend that women weren't gay in this kind of, they don't talk about it as much as with men, but as you'll find later on, Irma may have had something going on. And it's the different kind of color coding so that the guards could tell why you were there and what your quote unquote crime was. It reminds me a bit, if you've ever seen the movie Sophie's Choice, Meryl Streep plays, she's not even Jewish in it. She plays the daughter of like a kind of Captain Von Trapp or Irma's father figure who was anti Nazi. And she ends up because she's guilty by association, she ends up like in Auschwitz, I believe it is. And she would have fallen into one of the subcategories, I guess, like political prisoners almost. Anyway, you can watch many documentaries about these different camps, including Ravensbrück. So there were SS administrators there, but the camp staff were mostly female guards who were assigned groups of women to oversee prisoners. These female guards were actually not members of the SS, but they were members of what was called the Female Civilian Employees of the SS, which I'm not going to try to pronounce in German. Ravensbrück had 18 barracks. It's small in comparison to Auschwitz-Birkenau, obviously, which is a huge compound that spans multiple different camps. I believe it at its peak, it was four camps. You now visit two when you go there. The 12 of the 18 barracks were housing, where prisoners slept in three-tiered wooden bunks. The other six were like an infirmary, lavatories, things like that. Obviously, sanitation was terrible, but it would get worse and worse as more and more prisoners were sent here, and women would sleep. You know, you learn this at Auschwitz, and you get to see the wooden bunks that they slept in, and you wonder how they would fit 20 people in a wooden bunk. Obviously, with overcrowding and bad sanitation comes different diseases, and typhoid and typhus spread wildly, and this is generally spread through rats. If you showed any kind of weakness, as is generally a common thread throughout concentration camp stories, you were essentially shot immediately, and that goes towards illness as well if you got sick for even one day. The SS staff also murdered prisoners in the camp infirmary by lethal injection. I've read stories about how they would do these experiments and just inject air into them, things like that. Chemicals that they still to this day don't know what they are. There's women that you can watch interviewed, one of whom's still alive, who was made sterile by having something injected into her at Auschwitz by Josef Mengele when she was just a little girl, which basically sterilized her. And to this day, they don't know what it was. And ultimately, they would transfer a lot of these women to Auschwitz-Birkenau on cattle cars to be killed en masse because there was just so many of them. In early 1945, the SS constructed a gas chamber in Ravensbrück. The camp already had a crematorium to dispose of the dead bodies, but now they were upping the ante like they were in a lot of concentration camps. Ultimately, between 5,000 and 6,000 prisoners at Ravensbrück would be gassed before the camp was liberated in April 1945. And at 17, this was the paradise that Irma Gresser found herself working in, and she loved it. Irma was actually initially rejected for a job at Ravensbrück. She went there when she was about 17 and a half because it really wasn't far from where she grew up in Wrecken. And they told her she had to come back when she was 18. So she did pretty much as soon as she turned 18. Irma and all other recruits, female recruits, had to pass a number of exams. One was a medical exam, which she passed. One was a police check, I suppose, which you could not have any kind of criminal record, which is ironic as, which she passed. And then they had to do a kind of German and Nazi literacy test where questions like, what is the abbreviation of SS and where did Adolf Hitler write his book Mein Kampf were given to them, and they had to answer those. Now, SS, I couldn't actually tell you off the top of my head, so I had to look it up. It's Schutzstaffel, which is German for protective shield. It's not Secret Service. And the question, the answer to the second question, if you're interested, although a lot of you probably know because it's in his law, you know, is that Adolf Hitler wrote the book Mein Kampf in prison. So Irma loved it. In fact, she excelled and relished so much in the degradation of other women that she, by the barely over 18 and having not been there very long, she received a promotion. She was no longer just a lowly overseer. She was now a guard, an Aufseherin, at Ravensbrück. Now, later, Irma, on trial, would say whatever she could to try to get herself out of this debacle. And she would say that she was forced to work at Ravensbrook against her will, which was proven false, not only because she was turned away and she came back later and no one was forced to work there against their will, but secondly, because just the sheer gusto that she attacked her job with thousands and thousands of witnesses, couldn't be denied. Of the 50,000 guards who served in Nazi concentration camps across the Second World War, about 5,000 were women. At Ravensbrück, the training of these women to become Aufseherinnen was pretty grueling. It lasted about a month, but Irma was so good and was so eager that she actually passed it in 3 weeks. It must have been the first time in her life, I guess, where she felt like she was good at something. Everything else had not been a good fit. She'd failed. She wasn't good at being a nurse. She wasn't good working on the farm. She didn't like that. And suddenly she's excelling. And I guess mentally, this is only going to spur her on, that she's on the right track, I guess. I'm manifesting this, you guys. So she did the training at Ravensbrück, and this training is basically designed to harden you up and to only firm up your devotion to the Nazi ideal. It's a little bit Clockwork Orange in a way, just nonstop propaganda. Not that a lot of these women even needed that. Now, in the first couple of days of training, it's interesting to note that witnesses would later say at her trial that she was not exactly the person that would ultimately get these vile nicknames for being just an absolute monster, of which we'll talk about in part two. In fact, people remembered her apologizing to a camp inmate for stepping in front of her. And then 4 days later, apparently Irma was cured of this politeness and humanity, as one source put it. So the Aufseherinnen were female-only titles. These women were generally picked from low to middle-class families. They were quite young, easy to mould, obviously, looking for work. They had very little work experience, which would mean that they didn't really have a whole lot of life experience or knowledge, which is another plus. You can mould them into whatever you want. But some of them had had careers before the onset of war where their careers had either become kind of obsolete during the war. Some of them were actually teachers, others were hairdressers, others were office workers or receptionists and the like. The ranks of women in these concentration camps working there was on a ranking system, which essentially goes 1, which is top dog, down to 15, which is the lowest. And an Aufseherinnen was around a 14, so it was kind of the lower rungs, but it was still a good promotion for Irma as she saw it. Number one is called the Oberaufseherinnen, which is the chief senior overseer, which is basically in charge of overseeing all of the guards. And number 15 was the Arrestführerin. Arrestführerin, which is arrested overseer. And so that's basically women who, as you kind of arrive, put you where you need to go at the camp. And so where Irma ended up was a step above that. Female guards were not actually expected to be cruel from what I read. They were expected to be like efficient, you know, that German efficiency. Most of them weren't overly sadistic naturally, and they weren't kind of reprimanded if they weren't. So it's another example of how Irma would kind of trial these different things, but for every argument she would later have, there would be someone who would go, no, because others weren't like this. Most of them were cold and cruel and bitchy and vindictive and did some really fucked up shit. But most of them weren't considered overly sadistic, doing things for the pure sake of it, both sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse. And Irma would end up doing all of those things. According to the book Prisoners of Fear, quote, brutality was part of the concentration camp system. The sadistic excesses in terms of sexual perversions and brutal beatings were, for the most part, rare, unquote. So they actually point in this book to, which I read excerpts from, to a woman called Clara Koenig, who was a camp guard who served at a number of different concentration camps, including in 1944 at Ravensbrück and a subcamp of Ravensbrück, which was outside of the city of Dresden in Germany. And Clara, it did not come naturally to her to be impolite or to be cruel towards inmates. And one of the ranks above her, one of the women, pointed out that Clara was too polite and she was too kind. And so she was ultimately sacked from her job. And, you know, this is another more evidence that Irma's full of shit, that she was forced to, because you would just get sacked. We don't know what happened to Clara Koenig or why she ended up there or what her real story was, but she seemed to have disappeared around the bombing of Dresden, which happened in February 1945, which pretty much flattened the city and killed large swaths of the population. Irma Gresser didn't just revel in the degradation of prisoners all day, every day, and then go to her kind of on-site guard barracks and chill out and read books or something. In her downtime, she had a lot of sexual relationships with fellow male SS officers, and as we'll get into in part two, female as well, and other people within the camp. I'll save that for part two. And this all started kind of at Ravensbrück, and historians would look back and say that, which you'll realise in part two, that Irma was actually like a psychosexual deviant, which is also really rare for women. So she's a bit of an anomaly, and I can understand why psychologists would want to, or, you know, historians would want to look back and kind of dive into her brain, because it would have been, if they'd kept it, amazing for research. According to Germaine Tillion, who wrote a book called Ravensbrück, quote, sexual relations between the SS and prisoners were strictly prohibited, but it seemed that liaisons between SS of opposite sexes were encouraged, and they lived in a kind of promiscuity some might call primitive, although their situation was anything but primitive. It appeared that all the Aufseherinnen, married or unmarried, had one or more constant SS lovers. And so it seemed they never overlooked an opportunity to talk comparisons with their colleagues. In addition to the lovers and the shop talk, their diversions, especially around solstices and equinoxes, were monstrous eating and drinking bouts, after which they were so far gone that men and women were unable to recall with whom they had spent the rest of the night, unquote. If you're wondering about the solstices, random curveball in that, and equinoxes, the Nazis like worked a lot with the occult and the phases of the moon. It's very strange. There's a really good last podcast on the left that is called, I think, Nazis and the Occult. If you want to kind of dive into that, they were quite superstitious. But in short, pretty much everyone was on with everyone and would openly talk about it. In fact, one of the really interesting things I came across researching Irma, which blew my mind, and I'd never heard this, and I've read like books and seen documentaries about Joseph Mengele at Auschwitz, the angel of death, as he was known, the doctor at Auschwitz. He and Irma, when she would ultimately be promoted to a position at Auschwitz and move there in Poland, they would have some sort of strange relationship, sexual relationship, which I'll talk about in part two. And it kind of stemmed from he would wait for the cattle cars to arrive and then assess people as they got off the trains. And when you got to Auschwitz, you stand right where he stood. And they don't talk about other major Nazis when you do the tour. They kind of just touch on the main well-known notorious ones. And I read that Irma Gresser would be like his assistant. She would stand right next to him. And I just thought that was very, very interesting fact, which I do believe. So by this point, it was 1940, and the mass extermination of Jews and other quote-unquote lesser-than-folk were well underway, and the home aggressor that couldn't find her feet in a normal pre-war economy suddenly was thriving. Irma Gresser was soon promoted from her lowly, I guess, Ravensbrück position in Germany to a guard position at Auschwitz-Birkenau, basically the center of the concentration camp machine, the largest concentration camp, the most notorious, located just outside of Krakow in southern Poland. By this point, Irma was 19 years old, and it was 1943. So Irma was incredibly proud. She had a full SS uniform by this point. She was always immaculately presented, as most of them were. And before she headed off, she decided to head home, which was not very far from Ravensbrück, to visit her father, who she really hadn't had much to do with. He had a new family, and he was not pleased with her job. They had barely spoken to her since she'd been away at Ravensbrück. And she knew that if she went in her full SS garb and uniform to visit her father, this would provoke him, and this is what she intended to do. So she went there and she rocked up in her full SS garb, knowing this would push him over the edge with his feelings about the Nazis. And this essentially was the final nail in the coffin of their relationship. They fought, he pleaded to Irma regarding her newfound career path and all the reasons not to follow it. And Irma dug her heels in and he cast her out, and he told her never to come home or to contact him ever again, which I don't blame him. Even if it's your child, if your morals and your ethics are that far apart, there's just no way of reconciling them. Later, when she was on trial, the only time through the whole trial when they would present her with evidence of all the atrocities that she would commit and all the evil to the core things that she would do to other people, she would not show any emotion. The only time that she showed any emotion and started to cry was when they brought up this visit to her father where he cast her out. But Irma at her core hated her father, and he could not offer her what the Nazi Party could. Routine, career growth, consistency, pride in being German. And so she set off for Auschwitz and her new role in the women's camp at Birkenau, which was essentially the death camp. It's barracks, but then it's all open. It's huge. I've talked about it, I think, on the Max Spears case, but there was about four camps, but now you visit Auschwitz 1. Depending on what season you go, I went in winter. It was extremely cold, which I talked about in depth on that episode, and gives you a real insight into how people lived, which I don't understand how they did. You go there for about 4 hours, and then you go to Birkenau for about an hour because it's so cold, and we walked the length of Birkenau, and it just seemed never-ending, and everyone was slipping on ice, and my boot broke, and it filled with icy water, and there was so much snow and ice, you could barely see the train tracks in the middle. I've got a few stark, haunting pictures I took at Birkenau, but it was so cold that I couldn't even get my camera out, and I didn't really want to. I've only got a couple. So the Auschwitz-Birkenau that Irma Gresser arrived into was the stuff of nightmares for anyone who wasn't a sociopath. The mass gassing and cremation of prisoners was in full force. Prisoners were being forced to participate in hard labour, not knowing whether today was going to be the day that they were just taken away and murdered. Anytime, as really well depicted in Schindler's List, anytime someone could just put a gun to your head and pull the trigger, which there's that famous scene in Schindler's List where he's trying to recalibrate a machine and the Nazi, who Ralph Fiennes plays, sets a timer. And there's another one, which is actually there at Plaszów, which is just outside of Krakow as well, but a smaller camp, where there's a woman who was an engineer before she was a prisoner. These people had lives, families, careers. It's like in The Pianist, he was a well-known man, with people who loved him, and they were just reduced to nothing. But this woman, they're building barracks, and the woman comes forward and she says, the foundation's too weak. I was an engineer. And he says, "What would you do?" Emon Gurth, who Ralph Fiennes plays amazingly in that, and she says, "I would do it this way." And then he just goes, "All right, thank you," and he just takes his gun and pulls the trigger and shoots her dead right there. And that was the reality. Not to mention people like him, and later we'll get into Irma Gresser, who he would just pick people off from his villa, which was on the site. He would just do target practice first thing in the morning, which is depicted in the movie Schindler's List, which actually happened if you read the book Schindler's Ark. So at Auschwitz, the four large crematoriums which you go into when you go to Auschwitz, which is bizarre still to say, and I went to Auschwitz like 11 years ago and it seems strange I was even there. They burnt day and night, also depicted in Schindler's List when prisoners would turn up, and there's that famous scene where they arrive at night and there's all the ash coming down from the crematoriums, and the women and their children get off the cattle car at the selection point in the middle of Birkenau, and the kids say it's snowing. And it was the ash coming from the crematoriums. The smell day in, day out, apparently drove like a lot of guards insane, which is also depicted in Schindler's List. If you haven't seen Schindler's List, it's obviously an amazing movie, but it's all incredibly factual. And I've got an amazing story on my list at some point to do regarding that. Guards displayed the most cruel and depraved behaviour you could ever imagine at Auschwitz. And obviously there was thousands of guards because the Auschwitz-Birkenau complex is huge. And even today you can only visit two, but there were four at the time. You actually get the bus from Auschwitz 1 to Birkenau. It's about a 5-minute bus ride. That's how big this complex is, and it's just outside of a town, which in German, I can't pronounce it in Polish, it's Oświęcim or something. The German of it is Auschwitz. And this was a normal town with normal people living there, a pretty little Polish town, and you can imagine that that's happening over your back fence. I mean, this is why it's hard for people to say they didn't know what was going on and for people to believe them when your neighbours are going missing, your friends and colleagues are going missing. They all have these similar traits in common, the Jews, the gypsies, they're seen as lesser than, and they never come back. And it seems to be happening everywhere. That's why I can't stomach hearing people say I had no idea, because we're talking about 4 intense years of this, really. So there was a female inmate doctor at Auschwitz who early on met Irma Gresser when she arrived at Auschwitz. Her name's Dr. Gisela Pearl. And she would later describe meeting Irma as Irma arrived at the site of some of the worst human atrocities in history. Quote, "She was one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen. Her body was perfect in every line, her face clear and angelic, and her blue eyes the gayest, the most innocent eyes one can imagine. And yet Irma Gresser was the most depraved, cruel, imaginative pervert I have ever come across," unquote. In her initial entry-level role, which lasted just over the first year that she was at Birkenau, Irma cut her teeth and proved herself with various often mundane administrative tasks. One was answering the telephone, another was going through the mail. Another time she was put in charge of commanding a squad of gardeners, which, what is the point of gardening there? I guess to make it look pretty as you're just seems insane. In May 1944, 8 months before the Soviets would finally liberate Auschwitz, and many of the guards would flee, often dressing up like the people they despised the most, which were Jewish people, which is what happened with Joseph Mengele, and I'll save that for another time, Irma received a promotion, another one. She was now an Oberaufseherin, which is the second highest rank that a woman in her position could achieve. She's like 21 years old, not even, she's 20. Now Irma would be tasked with being in charge of 30,000 women at Birkenau. 30,000. Irma had arrived. And this was when she unleashed what many believe she had repressed since she was a child, where she would run away from conflict when other girls were fighting. Irma was renowned for wearing her well-pressed, pristine SS uniform proudly, and most survivors' accounts all talked of the exact same things, three things. She wore heavy boots, which were almost like black boots that came up to, they refer to them as jack boots, below her knee. She always had a pistol with her and she always had a whip with her. And every survivor account who had any kind of run-in with Irma, which is thousands and thousands of women, although many of them did not survive, they would refer to these three objects, the pistol, the whip, and the jack boots. And later on, her love of using dogs to instill fear in people. Prisoners obviously did not get the luxury of bathing and the camp smelled like death. I read a little bit from Viktor Frankl's book to you on a recent episode. I believe it was the Yossi Ginsberg case. And he talked a little bit about that, but he does talk about it if you read the book. And these are all the visceral kind of things that I think hit home to people that this isn't just something that happened in history that feels really distant when you describe the smell of things and the taste of things and just the feel of things. It creates, it makes it a lot more real for people. And you can just imagine the camp smelled like feces, open sewage, urine, the crematoriums constantly going, dead bodies laying there in the summer, in the heat, and in the winter, often frozen, menstrual blood, you know, urine, body odour. To taunt prisoners that were being forced to live like this, many of whom had been upstanding and well-off and respected members of their communities before the onset of war and the removal of Jews from their communities, Irma Gresser would wear very rare and expensive perfumes that she would send off for and have delivered to her. And this was not just because she enjoyed them, it was to really psychologically damage the women that were under her control. Olga Lengyel, who was another inmate doctor, who would later go on to write a book about her experiences, because a lot of Jews were forced to work as doctors alongside the Nazi doctors. She said of Irma, quote, "It defied belief that such a pretty girl could be so cruel. When she walked through the camp with a whip in her hand, she was surrounded by a cloud of choice perfume," unquote. Soon survivors and, you know, prisoners would give her many different nicknames, the beautiful beast, the blonde angel of hell, and notoriously the hyena of Auschwitz. And later on, when she would be moved to Bergen-Belsen prison, concentration camp in Germany, she would be called the bitch of Belsen. And despite earning a good wage, Irma still reveled in plundering the belongings of prisoners. Suitcases full of things close to the hearts of people that they had bought with them in the vain hope that they would have access to them or they would get them back at the end of all of this. And you will see many of these behind glass in the incredible museum that is at Auschwitz One. I have a couple of photos of things that kind of grabbed my attention, one of which is a photo of women's shoes behind a glass case and this red pair of tap shoes that a woman who we don't know who, bought with her because those were what was special to her. Now, obviously, Nazis would get first dibs, the guards would get first dibs on what came through. And as a result, Irma had a constant influx of European clothes, often designer label, to pick through and to wear. This is what I've always struggled with, why I don't believe that they truly believed that Jewish people were dirty or sick or, I don't necessarily believe that most of them think that, because if they really did believe that, A, they wouldn't have fled after the war. A lot of them would say, no, I was right, and, you know, dig their heels in and say, put me on trial because I was right, if they really believe that. But B, They wouldn't have sex with prisoners, which a lot of them did if they really believed they were as filthy as they said they did. And C, they wouldn't wear the clothes of prisoners like a lot of them did if they really felt that their previous owners were, you know, filthy vermin. So that's why I don't believe that they actually believed it, a lot of them, that they were just reveling in the power that they had. It's one thing I've always kind of struggled with, and I honestly don't believe a lot of them thought that. It was just a complete power trip. When she did order new clothes to be tailored for her, she sent orders to designers in Vienna and Budapest. And Irma also didn't let her self-care practices lapse. In her downtime, when she wasn't, you know, screwing married SS, you know, men in the SS or women, as we'll get into in part two, or just being a horrible bitch in general, she would spend a lot of time, witnesses would say, in front of her mirror, surprise, surprise, fixing up her face and her hair. It always had to be immaculate. According to Warfare History Network, quote, she imagined herself as a movie star and once declared, after the war, I'm going to be in films. You will see my name as a star on the screen. I know life and I've seen many things. I feel my experiences will be useful in my career as an artist, unquote. Just to remind you, she was 20 when she said this, so she had a pretty inflated ego. So I'm going to leave it there for part one. I'll be back in a few days with part two, which will be kind of the most intense part. I hope that you're getting something out or learning something from the story of Irma Gresser. I guess that's all you can hope for with stories of people like this, that you learn what not to do or people to avoid. And I will be back then. I hope that you all have a really good week. It's early on in the week here. You know, it's Monday in Australia, Monday afternoon. And I was back a little bit early for you guys with a new episode. It hadn't been quite yet a week, but I wanted to make up my absence like for a month at the end of November to end of December for you guys. So, I guess Yoko has an internal timer because she's just turned up looking for food and she's rubbing against my phone. So I will go and feed her and I'll be back with part two shortly.